network, I'm looking at sort of how can we support people like yourselves in your work in the community to work on public issues. So that's widely defined, people in school systems, where we define education as a public good. It might be in communities or regions of the country or the world where they're working on economic development, where they're trying to improve the economy, where they're working on issues of poverty. So it's broadly interpreted. And we spent a lot of time looking at then how do you build leadership capacities. And so one of the things that we're finding is that we have good understandings about that just out of our own lessons of experience. So this morning what I thought we'd do is try to learn from each other to say, what have we learned about being centered in our work, which is a very important component of leadership, is to get personally focused and centered. What have we learned about the ability and the practice of doing that, the discipline of doing that, that we might sort of learn from each other? So I want to get into that question, but before I do that, I want to say a little bit about the question at hand, which is, when in your work or your service have you been most spiritually centered? I want to tell you why I chose that question, as opposed to what are the skills that are most helpful for you, or what are your gifts that are most helpful, but what does it mean to sort of be centered around the things that are important to you, and why I sort of raised that question. First of all, I want to say that leadership, according to the Gospel of Luke, a leader is anyone who serves. So I think that's very inclusive. It's not sort of the positional leader in an organization, but I would define leadership and leader then are all of us in our service capacity in our life's work. So rather than saying some people go to leadership school and other people go to followership school, I think I'd like to talk about then our service work, that part of all of us in our work as servants. But I want to say a little bit about, I think more and more people who are sort of studying and researchers who are doing research on leadership are looking at this spirit, the notion of spirit and meaning in leadership, not as a skill, but it's when I was coming out here, I just read a speech that Parker Palmer had given about the need to be more disciplined and the leadership from within and our work and for all of us to do internal work about what's important rather than sort of learning skills out here, but to know what drives us from within. But he's not the only one. Some of you are familiar with Robert Greenleaf's work, and there's a center actually. He was a senior manager at AT&T, one of the top people there for a long time, and then founded a center on applied ethics. But he's done a lot of work in writing on something called the servant leader. He's dead now, but he defined it very much, leadership as a spiritual quest. So for each of us, what would that mean for each of us? I mean, what's our own personal spiritual quest? Max Dupree, who some people, he's chairman of the board of Herman Miller, which is a big company that manufactures furniture, and he's written several books on leadership, but he says, leaders create bonds that fulfill deep needs and give work meaning, that reaching one's potential is more important than reaching one's goals. I have a friend that's always coming out to me and saying, Sharon, have you reached your potential yet? And I just hate it when he does that. It's so much easier to talk about goals. I mean, it sort of lets me off the hook. You know, and I get concerned sometimes when some of us are teaching organizations to set up goals rather than inviting us in to think about what's our potential. I think maybe sometimes that goes deeper than just kind of superficial goals. So what's the potential of the church as opposed to the goals of a congregation? You know, that's another way of looking at it. Another consultant that does a lot of work in the United States and also in the United Kingdom talks about the essence of leadership stems from the leader's soul rather than from his or her behavior. Peter Block, who is a big consultant. I've done some work with him. He's very popular. He does a lot of work in the corporate world. He doesn't like the word leadership. He thinks he's much more interested in stewardship, being accountable and being responsible for what's been created and needs to be created. So that raises the question, what needs to be created and why? And how do we decide, how do we answer those hard questions? Shirley MacLaine, who got a lot of billing in this country. But I think it's interesting that she got reported in the Wall Street Journal on several occasions. And she, you know, really said that spiritual and religious values go hand in hand. So, you know, and I think that got a fair, you know, it got people's attention. So I think maybe there were, whether or not we sort of believed what she was saying, I think it rattled our cage a little bit. Scott Peck, who some of you are familiar with his work, he sees no reason why a spiritual rebirth couldn't or shouldn't happen in the workplace. So now, what does that mean? You know, because I think in the United States, we have very much segregated religious life with work life, paid labor, right? That's not true in other countries, but I think more and more I'm hearing people who spend a lot of time working and developing leadership capacities in the workplace talking about values and spirit and spirituality. Stephen Covey, who a lot of people read, and he's for a long time has been on the bestseller list, and you know, he wrote this book called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, but one of the habits is being proactive. And to be proactive means to be proactive about the things you care deeply about. So that's a habit. So how do we build that habit? How do you in your life go within to know what's important to you and to be proactive about that? So and Stephen says people are seeking more spiritual and moral anchors in their lives and in their work. So he is always hearing from a lot of us who are saying, how do you do that? Peter Senge, who some of you might be familiar with, he wrote a book called The Fifth Discipline. It's the art of a learning organization, and a lot of us are sort of looking at that model. One of the 5 disciplines, he says, of a learning organization is personal mastery. And personal mastery is being able to take our own personal values and align them with the work, some way our work that we're concerned about as individuals is aligned with the work of the organization. And if we don't have that kind of alignment, we have a hard time sort of sustaining ourselves in a meaningful way in organizations that we're working in. So he would call that the discipline of personal mastery. So some alignment of our own personal values and spirit with the spirit of the values of the organizations we're working in. Ken Blanchard and Norman Vincent Peale wrote a book called The Power of Ethical Management. And in that, they said people can't know what's going on in a traditional sense. There's a lot of ambiguity in today's world, in the context of today's world. And some people call it chaos. Margaret Wheatley wrote a book on the management of leadership, the new management style, which is the management of chaos. When people become unsure, the spiritual becomes important. So I think there's this emergence of kind of concern about the spirit and spirituality. A lot of the leadership centers that I work with around the world, I think, are shifting their focus from doing a lot of work in knowledge and skills and behaviors to the discipline of examining attitudes and values. Raising questions like, who am I? Who are we? What's important? What's going on? A lot of those questions, that's different than how do you run a meeting? And they're sort of suggesting that if we don't get a rigorous conversation about what's important, that we don't know how to center our work or focus the work that we do. So a lot of people that I work with are saying, no, there are these spiritual or value questions. Tom Peters, who a lot of you know, and he gets a lot of publicity in the corporate world, he sort of champions corporate values and spirit, yet he's very opposed to seeing anything in terms of spirituality in the workplace. So, and I'm not sure how you do that, that you examine corporate values and spirit, yet he would say, but not workplace spirituality. He thinks we need to separate religion, values and religion, with sort of the spirit of the workplace. And I puzzle as to kind of how can you do that? How can we as individuals do that? But there is some debate among a lot of people who are sort of looking at this. Bill George, who was a senior vice president of Honeywell in the Twin Cities and now is the CEO of Medtronic, and I did some work with him. But he's feeling that the importance of finding significance in our work is absolutely essential in terms of not only our well-being, but the well-being of the organizations that we work in. So that he says it's not necessarily sort of practicing religion in our organizations beyond religious organizations like our workplace or community-based organizations, but it's devoting our whole being toward a higher purpose in our work. So that then I think it challenges us to know what are the disciplines of going within and finding higher purpose in our work, or going within and knowing what our values are. So in my experience, as I work with a lot of different groups, I sometimes will ask people, what's important? And a lot of us list about 30 things or 35 things or 40 things that are important. And then it's no wonder that we feel like our life is chaotic. Because if we have 40 things that are important, then it becomes increasingly more difficult to be focused and to be grounded. Because there are all these sort of dilemmas about the important things in our lives. Can some of you identify with that? It's sort of like you feel like you should be 10 different places at once and they're all important for different reasons. So what I'd like to do is just open today's conversation up to thinking about in your own work, in your own lives, times when you feel like you've been sort of spiritually centered. And what can we learn from each other about sort of those times when you sort of were on the right track in your own work? And that's that notion of, I think, that a lot of times we don't take advantage of our own lessons of experience, so we're always sort of looking out there. So I'd like to look at our own stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before we do that, would you mind if we quarrel a little bit with all these other things
Sure.
you've been saying?
Sure.
I don't know that, I mean quarrel, but you said several things that seem to be very significant and raised some questions that are very significant. And I see, on the one hand, from the Christian perspective, we can't compartmentalize life and separate work from faith. On the other hand, while one needs to be in harmony, certainly, with the organization, there's no necessity for the Christian in the workplace to be at all offensive to anyone. However, it seems to me that the church has two or three things to offer and two or three things to learn from what you were saying. It has to offer the worship, the personal prayer and the corporate worship. For this points to the transcendent. This points to that which gives direction, guidance, and as well as power and spirituality for the person. The church also offers community. Unfortunately, it doesn't practice this very well. It still believes in individualism and therefore fails to take along with this leadership, this servanthood, that the Christian is where two or three are gathered together. There is the Christ. And it seems to me that in the workplace, the person, while he goes there in the power and the guidance of the worship, in order to do the work well, needs at least one other person, two or three. It needs at least one other person for support in what he's doing, either the person in the workplace or on the outside who is supporting the work. So I think the church is often irrelevant because it fails to concern itself with building support groups in the occupations. But I think the church has such a deep and profound message that the workplace will always be scattered until there is some semblance of understanding that what Jesus said of summing up the law, love God, love all people.
That's very helpful. Some people are even discussing that, sort of that new leadership work about seeing religious groups and discussion groups emerging in workplaces as a means. So what I hear you saying is that if we sort of keep track of our that the church can become a key resource in leadership work in a couple ways. One, in the disciplines that it teaches in terms of prayer, right? The workings of the church can be a really helpful resource to people about in their leadership work in general. And secondly, in creating community, that community is a resource for us to help us do more together than we could do as individuals. But the other thing I think that is important is that in terms of our mind, of how we organize our lives, of not segregating sort of work out there from work in here, and sort of a warning about that.
Along that line, the church needs to recognize that the church is in business and industry and politics and schools and hospitals and wherever its people are. The church is already there, and it fails to see this.
I'm just going to keep track of some of these things so that we don't lose them. So we've got community, but also prayer and worship. See, almost as we think of skills, but these are key resources to leadership in general, but trying to integrate those more. What about some of you in your work when you felt like you're really on a roll? When you're really, and that doesn't necessarily mean success, right? I want to clarify that it doesn't mean when things worked out well. All of us know people when they were successful in their leadership work got killed. So what about when you reflect back on your own life, on times that you felt like you were really centered? What was going on?
In my experience in teaching, there's one year that really, really stands out as a year when I think all of us as a group felt like we were really working as a unit. There was an organismic feeling of togetherness in the sense that you referred to community, and it was pretty much felt in the organization. And the unique characteristic that made that so satisfying to us was that there was a leader who viewed his role not as a linear leader who was possessed all the secrets of knowledge and the skills to make it successful, but he gave it away, and he articulated that he was there for 1 year. We had out of the 25 years, this is the one administrator that I felt a real sense of congeniality with. And at the heart of that, I think, was a sense of trust, a sense of shared leadership that spoke to his trust of us, and that he couldn't do it alone. And to really have us realize a vision, that we articulated, was going to take the involvement and participation of every person in that organization in a way that was meaningful, in a way that acknowledged each person in the group. And what was accomplished in that year was astounding. And the feeling of ownership, the feeling of contributions that each person made, it was enlightening in the group. So I think that's not a shared leadership and a willingness to give it away and seeing that it's not one person that creates leadership.
Okay. I want to capture all of these things. One is this core value of trust. I mean, that this was a core value of the environment. Another thing I heard you saying is that there was, in terms of the relationships there was shared power, but also shared responsibility, linking those two together. And the third thing I heard you saying was that a key resource, as seen as a key resource, was not just how much money do we need, but what are the individual gifts, and really taking that seriously, not just saying it, but being authentic about it, of really trying to use the individual gifts as a resource in the organization. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. What about?
So many things when thinking about finding stimuli. I know Shakti Gawain, who's written different books on creative visualization and transformation. One of the things she says is that people often are happiest, you know, in terms of their work. They think back of the gifts they had or the things they were drawn to as children. And then if they're able to do that same kind of thing, or using whatever those gifts are as adults, they're going to be happiest. And so that rings true for me, that those things that sometimes that I'm gifted in are not things that can make money very well, or that can be, that I have been able to use some in education, or maybe a lot in education, writing music, teaching second language instruction in a really creative way, theater, those kinds of things with not necessarily mathematics, but being able to use some of my gifts some of the time. In administration, I felt, I think that, at least for me, that 1 year, who knows if I would go back and do it again, was so damaging in so many ways that I guess maybe because I felt like I couldn't, my gifts weren't necessarily acknowledged, especially those of personal integrity and trying to be honest and working with people and growing, that was not acceptable behavior in the role of a principal, at least at that particular time. So I guess I wanted to say something about the gifts. And when talking about when I've been most spiritually centered, it's when, I belong to a support group of women who have children with special needs, because our child has special needs, and that's been very difficult for me. And for a lot of those women who have children with very severe disabilities, we've gotten together, and I've kind of taken a leadership role in that group, and providing, kind of organizing a retreat for them, a spiritual retreat. I've had a lot of experience working with small groups, organizing retreats, doing interpersonal communication, meditation, so I can bring something together and kind of lead these women to maybe some healing, because often there's a lot of guilt for us when, the birth and et cetera, our kids aren't exactly what we wanted, or, it's just a painful life that you're living. So bringing them to maybe some of the healing that's possible, some of that spiritual healing, which helps us grow as individuals. And I lead trips to Sedona for women, sometimes who are really burnt out, or just need time to be alone, to listen to nature, listen to themselves, to meditate, to pray, to be together, to work out, to be honest and truthful, to say who we are and where we are in our lives, to share that sense of fellowship. So that's probably when I feel most powerful, most spiritually centered, and doing the work, always incorporating the music that I write. And
let me go back. I don't want to miss these.
So
I mean, honesty came up, telling the truth. I mean, it sounded like you gave an example of kind of when you were distracted, but also maybe there was something when things were working right for you. It wasn't an environment where people could at least share their view of what was going on. Honesty is a hard thing, because sometimes it's seen as sort of a matter of opinion. So I tell the truth and you have a perspective. but this notion of creating an environment where we all get to talk about our view, as opposed to sort of being put down that we're not well enough educated or we don't see it right. But it sounds like when things work right, it's in an environment where there's sort of honesty, that people feel like they can talk openly.
Yeah, the trust, it's interesting because when you're in the position of authority, what I found is I made mistakes, and so people felt that they couldn't trust me, or, you know, that was it. Mm-hmm. You hang the laundry up and you don't get a second chance kind of thing, especially when you're making, you make mistakes that affect people's lives, but when you're in the position of authority, there isn't necessarily the room for dialogue or something like there is when you're not in a position of authority. There's a little bit more room, I think, for that. That's what I found hardest is trust, and also me trusting other people. I found that people would go behind your back and get angry, and so there wasn't a dialogue.
I think I also heard you saying that in terms of the way people relate to each other, there's a sense of healing and this is my word, caring, but it sounded like the relationships between people were very caring relationships, almost a fix-it relationships, that people relating to each other. Another thing that I heard you say was that people listened, that was an important ingredient to be able to listen. A key resource was music for you, of being centered, that music was an important thing. Also, a key resource were individual gifts and people's history. And you also mentioned the community, which was mentioned earlier as a key component that we need to pay attention to. I thought also the way it was organized, that it was not just seeing gifts as a resource, but aligning people's gifts with the work that needed to be done, which is an organizational task. I mean, it's one thing to say here in the village that everybody has gifts, but it's another whole chapter to say how do we align those gifts with the life of the community, right? So, and I think you mentioned that in terms of when it was working for you, it wasn't just that your gifts were recognized, but they were actually aligned with the work. I mean, that they were taken advantage of. And somehow, sometimes I think it gets read as being, you're not serious when you tell me I have a gift, but nobody gives me an opportunity or helps me contribute what I have.
One of the things you said in the middle is the personal mastery. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting concept, different kinds of personal mastery, whether we're trying to master skills in our workplace or, you know, we're trying to develop into deeper spiritual beings, trying to be more conscious of what we're doing, trying to let go of some of the, you know, our defects or sin or whatever you want to call it, trying to change and be better people. That's a big challenge. That's a big challenge. And what I find hard in life, and this is that some people are trying to do that, and some people don't have a clue that maybe that's a good idea, that they're not on necessarily any path of transformation. Maybe they're just in a survival mode. And so when you're working in an organization where there's different levels of awareness of people, in terms of communication, in terms of how they treat other people, in terms of maybe give and take, in terms of trying to better themselves or look at themselves and be reflective. You said reflective leadership. Reflective leadership is very painful. When I look back, that's what I can't get past, is some of the reflection of some of the mistakes. It's like, God, when do I get to move on? Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's all I have to say.
It's interesting that that's an ingredient of it all, is that rigor and that pain. And to a certain extent, I think that gets dropped. I mean, I used to think that leadership was about being sort of appointed and being asked and being sort of crowned. You know, it's kind of like, I'll be selected. Mm-hmm. That leaders are selected, so I was waiting. I worked with 35 older women in the state of Minnesota. They were trying to help me figure out something about the leadership of older women. And one of the best lessons that they gave me was that their view of leadership is leadership is for those who you have to show up. It's about, so, you know, it's kind of like, that's a skill, you know, show up. I thought, well, I can handle that. But there's pain in showing up sometimes.
Uh-huh. They must have been quilters.
Some of them were. What else? What
in my experience,
go ahead.
Most creative work spiritually, I think, was being a mother, raising children. I think it's a very serious and
what was that like for you? I mean, what things come to mind when you look back on your...
I had five children who were very close together in age. And it gets hard, especially when they're teenagers and trying to decide how much apron string to let go and how much trust you can let go. And making productive citizens of those children. It's complicated.
But for you, that was a time when you felt really centered, like you were on a
roll.
And
that I needed God's help.
Okay.
And direction.
The things are never as they appear. That here we have sort of direction as a resource. But I mean, some things that it's hard, and I would say maybe that a core value is hard work. That when we get centered, it's not about being easy. There's rigor in it. You know, I think sometimes that's sort of a myth, that when you're good at something, it's easy. But I think that's an important component as a value, that you have to work hard at it. But the focus of the work of raising children is interesting. I mean, if we call this our focus. And then you talked about being able to let go, which is
part of
a relationship, right. But sometimes we talk about sort of relationships as controlling. And so the discipline of letting go, we could spend a whole hour just talking about that. I think, you know, for me that's hard. It's some of the things I'm trying to practice here in Holden is that I'm trying to listen, and I'm trying not to control conversations of other sessions and that sort of thing, and trying not to raise my hand, but trying to kind of be on the intake side. It is hard. I'm trying to learn how to do that. I think this notion of God's help and direction is a resource to you in that work, that a critical, central resource. And that raises a lot of other questions as to kind of, in your own history, how did you come to know that so that you can draw on it? And so that it can ultimately sort of help you raise children. I mean, these are all interconnected.
In the 1980s, the government pumped a lot of money into drug prevention programs. And we were very fortunate in Charles City that our guidance counselor was able to write a grant and it was accepted. And so I'd say for about 10 years, we would go on retreats. There would be a group and the focus would be prevention and self-esteem and an action plan and that type of thing. And going away together and not having any outside influence and building community, you know, that starts with the superficial and then the chaos and ending up with the, you really feel centered and focused and a part of a group and that you're working together for something. And there's a true sense of community. And we haven't had that for about 4 or 5 years, and I can really see the difference because now we're all disjointed again because the local community decided, or the local school board decided that they wouldn't fund this, and the government money, you know, ran out. So there's a lot to be said for getting away together, you know, building community and going through that whole chaotic state and then get to the sense of community and working together.
themes. One is how you organize things, intentionally organizing things away.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, almost have to get away because there was no outside influence. There was no telephone calls. They couldn't go home and do the laundry. They couldn't go home and take care of the kids. They couldn't go home and mow the lawn. They couldn't, you know, we were away.
So you get a new view. It's like some of the people that I work with from other parts of the world who spend a year in the United States, that it gives them a new mirror on their own countries. Mm-hmm. I mean, they learn more about their own country and their own situations as they do the United States. Mm-hmm. But it gets it real clear as to kind of who they are and what their work's about. So going away, I mean, just organizing ourselves so that we have a place to go away with for reflection maybe becomes important. I think interesting you mentioned community kind of as a resource, your colleagues, but also a relationship that you worked on was to build community. That there's a rigor in that, that's about the relationships of you and your colleagues together. There was sort of an action component, and also sort of working together. A lot of us are in places where our real work is private, and so meetings get in the way. Mm-hmm. And so we have to hurry up and get through the meeting so we can get to our real work, right? But it sounded like when you felt centered, it was when it was working together was very authentic and real.
Mm-hmm. And when you have like an hour meeting, you get the superficial and you never get through. People are afraid to say anything. You never really get anything accomplished. But if you're together for 5 to 7 mm-hmm. days, you know, and you're working on something, you can get everything out and really get down to the true community mm-hmm. and what you're working for and everybody's input and build that level of mm-hmm. trust. You know, it makes a... Then when we got to meeting time, when we got back, the meetings were real effective
uh-huh.
because we already had gone through all of the stuff,
yeah.
everybody's stuff, uh-huh. and we didn't, you know, we weren't afraid to say anything, and we could do it because
uh-huh. you understood each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I worked for a company that handled that in what to me now seems kind of unusual. It was a very small section of a managed care company, so it was within a big organization, but a small unit of that, and the director of this company would have two different kinds of meetings. He would have, I guess you'd call them spiritual growth meetings or community building meetings, and he would have business meetings. And it was a very, very formal company as far as, you know, the women all wore suits. It was, you know, really formal. But yet we had these, you know, community building times during the day he would set aside, even though everybody was off doing their own thing at a very rushed, very high pace. He would set aside, you know, maybe 2 hours on Friday for a community activity, turn off all the phones, take away all of the outside influences, just like you're saying, except on a much smaller scale. And we would just have time to be together and kind of relate with each other in a work setting, unfortunately, but, you know, around work and around ourselves and how we were doing with the work that we were doing. What it meant to us.
Was that helpful for you?
Yes, very. It made me feel more like I could trust the people that I was working with. It was a time where responsibilities were redistributed. If somebody was having a problem with the work that they were doing, if they needed assistance, that was a time that they could bring that up. And, you know, when that might not be appropriate in a business meeting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was different, and it was always a party type setting too. You know, everybody would bring in, there was like a $4.97 limit, and you could bring whatever you want within that. And it was kind of a really funny thing because how much food can you produce, you know, on a $4.97 budget? And, you know, so people would bring in their receipts, and, you know, it'd be, you know, bulk flour by, you know, 19 cents. And it was really kind of a joke, but it was a lot of fun. And they were all big into cooking, and so it was also very tasty. So.
A few things that I heard coming out that were maybe applicable to some situations, this notion of a party in terms of relationship, but that was sort of a symbol for shared responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
That everybody sort of, in terms of how we related, it wasn't one person in charge, but actually another thing I heard you, in an organizational sense, it was a time when responsibilities were adjusted. Mm-hmm. A lot of organizations have a real hard time with real rigid structures and role structures, and so it's not my job, and it's a big deal to sort of open those things up.
Right.
As opposed to, it sounds like this was a setting where it was just a way of life, and assignments were always being adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
So that flexibility became important. Again, you mentioned this notion of trust.
Mm-hmm.
As sort of a value. Trust was an important value in sort of in that setting. Interesting ideas about how can we make our work together so that we adjust responsibilities more easily.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
About 10 years ago, I had an interesting experience of working on a grassroots committee. I live in a small community of about 10,000 people on an island in Puget Sound. And four or five mothers, we had small children at that time, we were sitting around a kitchen table drinking coffee. And we decided, just through conversation, that we did not think that our schools were serving the artists in our community in a way of integrating artists and residents in the school, and that we didn't have any art specialists at that time in either of our elementary, junior high, or senior high. So we just got to talking about this, and I think, just like I said, but because of our deep love of the visual arts, and of dance and of music, we decided that we would write a grant. And we looked into what it would take to write a grant and whose approval we would have, and how we could work with the schools. And there were six of us on that committee, and there were no leaders, which was, I think, for me, made it a very rewarding experience, because the only leadership we had to look toward was toward ourselves. And in a very informal, unstructured way, we were able to come up with what it was that we thought we could do best. And lo and behold, we got the grant. Then we were terrified. Then we really had to act upon this. And I think that once we got the grant, that kind of gave us a little bit of clout, because now we had money. And it also made us viable, because we would go to the school board and we'd say, now we have a grant, this is working. So together, the six of us in the last 10 years have put artists, have put specialists in all of our schools by really talking that through and finding ways and finding out that it was important to other parents that we would have art specialists in all of our schools. And we've also done a partnership with our Allied Arts Group of putting artists into the schools, and we've put, through grant writing, over $100,000 in our schools in the last 10 years. And these were just some people sitting around a coffee table, and that's how it all began. But I really believe that what centered us and what brought us together was really because of that one deep love of art. That was what it was. We knew that we had, none of the focus was artificial or contrived or put upon us from anyone else. And I think that has been something that it's probably the only committee I've ever worked on where I felt good about what happened in the end. Many other times I've tried committee work and I thought, what are they talking about? I don't agree with any of this. You know, and I've left. I just quit and left. And then I felt bad about myself because I didn't stay on it. I didn't stay on board. All that. And I've come to realize that if it isn't something that I have a passion for, I'm not as interested in taking on any kind of a task, of a self-leadership role. And I think that really, that's been one thing for me as a classroom teacher, has been I've tried to help students to see what it is that they do have that passion for, and not to keep always beating themselves up because they aren't as interested in this cause or this issue or that issue, but to find what it is, and then to understand that is, it's okay not to be good or not to be active in everything. And that's taken me a while to realize that.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. to really look to seeing that you can have a structure without having a chairperson, without having a facilitator, without having all of these different things, if you have a common cause. Mm-hmm. And that was when I have decided it's been the most rewarding to me.
We started taking a look in the center, and over time, with a lot of the groups and communities and organizations and regions and countries that we've been working with, and early on, conversations come up about resources, we don't have enough money, help us find more money, mm-hmm. Help us restructure. But over time, we're beginning to see that the real questions that these groups are, so, you know, we didn't have a chair, we didn't have the, those are often concerns, but when we sort of started working together and over a long period of time, oftentimes the real rigor and focus became, what are we really trying to do? Why is this important? Is it important to all of us? And how are we going to relate to each other to get the work done? And then those needs to kind of look at the organizational structure mm-hmm. fell by the wayside. But oftentimes that's our initial concern is, how are we going to structure ourselves? And how much money do we have? And we spent enormous amounts of time there. And to a lot of people, that's boring stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, who cares on how the church is organized and how much money it has? Mm-hmm. You know, but we spend a lot. I mean, if we started monitoring how much time is spent on those things. Mm-hmm. So this is an argument that we need to refocus our dialogue to about what's really important here. Mm-hmm. And how we might get that work done. But I want to point out something about it was interesting that your fear that you were terrified. Mm-hmm. I think that has something to do with courage. But valuing that fear, not letting it become a distraction. I think sort of embracing that, like it was okay. Mm-hmm. I think personal passions were a key resource for you. Mm-hmm. Something that excited you all. I thought that your organization of sitting around was an interesting one. Mm-hmm. How do you organize yourself? Well, we sit around.
Yeah.
I mean, that is kind of nice.
What I hear is they had a common cause, yes. Uh-huh. Which would be.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a nice way to put it. What I also heard is, you know, the art that was real. You know, it was a real focus. It wasn't, you all sort of knew how to define that. You didn't have to go look at the mission statement.
Right, we never did a mission statement.
I'm always concerned when organizations have a mission statement, but in order to kind of describe it or summarize it, they have to go get it.
Right.
Then I think you can't work off of it. You know, unless you know it sort of in your own words. Mm-hmm. It's probably not very useful for you. Mm-hmm. I have a friend, and also you said though that it was real, mm-hmm. Which is this notion of authenticity, a sort of walking our talk.
Right.
You know, that those two were sort of mm-hmm. aligned together. I have a friend who sent me this card, I just love it, and it said, all I care about really is world peace and thin thighs. And you open it up on thin thighs.
Oh.
Okay, and you open it up on the inside and it says, I was just kidding about world peace.
That's great.
It's this notion of being real, you know, and it's what I say, most organizations have a real mission and a stated mission. And we spend a lot of time sort of designing and developing the stated mission. But it's sort of like when we're centered spiritually, at least in your example, it was like for real.
Well, we weren't hampered by any expectations either. And I think sometimes we're so hampered by outcome. You know, we just sort of ambled along. And lo and behold, these gifts came to us. And it was, had we had expectations to where we would have felt that we were falling short, you know, we're such a product-oriented society, and we didn't necessarily have a grand product in mind. Mm-hmm. We weren't really working towards something that had an end or had a mm-hmm. product-oriented result. It was more the process, and we became involved in the process, and if something good happened along the way, if it worked for 3 months, well, it was better than nothing. Mm-hmm. For 6 months, that was grand, and that's how we approached it, and it's been great.
Do you agree that that's terribly important?
Outcomes?
I mean, no, what she was just saying about we didn't really
we weren't hampered by expectations. Mm-hmm. It seems to me there's a great truth there.
Well, I just, it's interesting because when you said that, I thought of a conversation that I had last week where, I may get fired or in trouble or whatever. But I was having a conversation. I chair the board of a community-based organization in the Twin City, in Minnesota, actually, that does community development work. And we do little projects. We don't feel like, we don't know how to do a lot of things, and we're trying to learn together with communities how to do them. So we have two projects going on right now. One is to support poor children in a low-income neighborhood in the city of St. Paul, and another one is to partner with women entrepreneurs in rural regions of Minnesota who are trying to build agriculture-related businesses. In general, but we both believe they're both in terms of community development. And in other lives, I spend a lot of time in foundations, and I have an argument because I see in the United States, and it's being pushed worldwide with some of the people I work with in other parts of the world, is the Ford Foundation, a lot of big foundations are into this outcome focus, and it's an organizational technique, and it's maybe not about focus, but it's manipulating outcomes, and so people are forgetting what their focus is, and they're just doing a lot of work on outcomes. And so I'm really frustrated when your life's work is to empower others. Then it feels manipulative to me to say, I'll decide what the outcomes are, and then we'll go empower them to do that.
Yes.
If you believe that your work is to help the community find its own focus and then help them bring to life that focus, then it seems to me that having to write the outcomes in order to get the grant, in order to do the work, is deceptive. It's inauthentic. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to do that, but I'm having that conversation now because a lot of foundations that I'm working with, and also I'm sitting on the other side of the table, are saying, well, you have to have outcomes. It's like you're incompetent if you don't have outcomes. It has something to do, I think, with trust. Mm-hmm. See, is that we don't really trust communities to do their own work, so let's get some folks to write the outcomes in advance. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm personally sort of challenged by some of it. I don't know how to think about it, but I'm having trouble in my own work, where in order to marshal resources for some of the groups that I'm working with, because that's often part of my job, is I don't know how to do that. And I'm asking foundations how to do that because I think we're getting set up or something. I'm not sure what's going on, but I am challenged by that.
I think one thing that's sort of coupled with that too is with this drive for outcomes, you know, that it's certainly in the arena in which I work, there's efficiency is tied, so you know there's time constraints. You've got to get these things done in this designated amount of time. And if you open it up to real authentic participation on the part of all the people concerned, it may take longer to arrive at an outcome, but the result may be infinitely more valuable because you've had the participation, the involvement, the ownership of everyone involved. And so often I see in organizations that one, you know, a few people will lead and they've got, you know, they already have an agenda in their own head as to what they want the outcome to be. Mm-hmm. And the problem becomes, how do you get everybody else to kind of come along with you and buy into your outcome, mm-hmm. your agenda? Mm-hmm. And of course other people are just sort of sitting there stone-faced, okay, mm-hmm. okay, sure.
The strength of the church, incidentally, along that line, is that we do have the bully pulpit.
And maybe those issues get very complex. I think sometimes they become power struggles. But it's for me one of the reasons why I think there's a difference oftentimes between leadership and leader. A couple years ago, I had one of the international fellows that I work with come into my office, and part of the work that our international fellows and scholars do is to they're working on public issues. So how to transform the courts in Uganda, or how to deal with human rights violations in Cameroon, or how to set up a new hospital system in Russia now that they're moving away from sort of a government-run system for everything. So they're working on public issues. But what they're doing is trying to bring together their issue with an action plan. And I would argue there's substance under both of these. And this part is what we call reflective leadership. Okay, so there's a leadership component to action. But one of the fellows came into my office and he was writing home. And he says, now Sharon, he was having trouble with the word leadership, which is a cultural, you know, I mean, it has cultural connotations. And he said, you know, if I write home that I'm sort of looking at, there's some leadership questions there, they'll think I'm trying to become king. It's like, you know, help me out here. So our words get in our way. But I think this has been very helpful for me, and I think it maybe helps us all in terms of how we frame our work and the discipline or sort of what do we need to look at if we want to ourselves personally try to keep centered, but also help others that we're working with, if you're working on a team, to be centered. So what do we say together in terms of our collective story? Seems to me that there are some core values in the environment that are important, or at least they were in our stories, that there needs to be trust. You know, you don't have workshops on trust. You have to work at that. That's an ongoing thing. Finding each other's work reliable. Knowing what's going to having a sense of when we show up what's going to happen. Not that we like each other, but that at least we can find each other's work reliable. Honesty, being able to kind of put out there and not being afraid that my view's not quite good enough, but that at least you have an opportunity to talk about how you see things and to ask questions about and understand why people see things the way they do, maybe. That becomes part of, rather than sort of ultimate truth, sounded like honesty was a much more complex sort of piece of the environment. Hard work, and what we're afraid of is that it embraced fear rather than tried to do away with it. You know, I mean, you just got on with it in light of the fact that you were terrified, as opposed to sort of taking out life and saying, well, let's not be afraid of what's going on. It was real clear that you had a focus, that a real focus. It wasn't just sort of a stated focus, but a real one that you didn't spend a lot of time worrying about, but you knew you were in focus on your work, that you knew what you were working on. Also that relationships were really important, how we related, the sense of shared power and responsibility, of a sort of healing and caring, and relationships, caring relationships. Listening, letting go, building community as an action, as a way of life, not as you've arrived, but seeing it as the journey. Working together, which might, you know, a lot of these are interrelated, but of having a party, which means shared responsibility. Then how the work was organized, that you weren't asked to kind of separate your faith from your work, that it was integrated, it was organized in an integrated way, so it wasn't segregated, that the organization itself helped to align everybody's individual gifts, which I think is really an interesting challenge for me to think about, is to kind of, how can we design systems that align people's gifts? Because we don't teach that in schools of management, I think. You know, we have a list of gifts out here, and we all go in and try to learn them real quick, as opposed to the journey and the discipline of trying to learn and identify our gifts and the gifts of people around us, and then try to find a way to align those with the work that needs to be done. It's a very different approach. I want to think more about that. That's helpful for me. That we organize it so that people can go away, that we create environments where people can get away from it that are reflective, that give us a new angle on things. That's an important thing, I think, for me here in the village, is that this is an important resource for me personally to kind of get away and kind of see things from a different perspective. that responsibilities are readjusted, which is really kind of nice. I'll have to think more about that. But a lot of organizations spend a lot of time writing job descriptions like they're in stone. And it's like, what would it look like? How do we do that if it was always kind of being changed? And then I like this idea of organizing a sit-around. Yeah, that's kind of nice. I like that. It's the kind of, how can we be rigorous about organizing sit-arounds? And then key resources for music. A resource that seeing God's help and direction as a central and a key resource for us, of personal passions as an important resource in each of us, community as a resource of prayer and worship as a resource for us, our individual gifts and our individual personal histories, and the histories of our people become an important resource that we don't separate ourselves from. So I think that's a rich sort of array of things that we might think about for ourselves in terms of how to get our work focused and kind of help us get at our spiritual center. But it's complex, not an easy sort of cookie cutter thing. But thank you. I really appreciate you sharing your stories, and it helps me kind of think about some work that I'm doing. So thank you. Thank you for coming.